We're back here in the restaurant with Larry Austin here on Calvus and Damon. Things are still loud. The ice is crashing into the buckets. And we're still eating
pizza. That's a performance piece. Aren't you aware?
Ah.
We're just across the street from the New England Conservatory, and there is a group of performers here. And it's ice music over there.
Ice music, all right.
Right.
Speaking of which. So we were finishing up the story of Open Style.
Yeah.
And where
by the way, it wasn't a movement. It was a one-man movement. I think no one else took up the banner, as it were.
Nicholas Slanimski apparently gives great credence to that movement.
Yeah. Well, I hate to explode the myth.
Speaking of myths, there was a CD sort of with that in the title, which reminds me that you are also one of the people behind some of the issuance of a lot of contemporary music, computer music in particular.
Oh, you mean CDCM?
CDCM.
Yes. Yeah, well, CDCM stands for the Consortium to Distribute Computer Music, which is quite a formidable academic style title, but and in fact it was a consortium of prominent American electroacoustic and computer music studios back in 86. I invited six other computer music composers who also happened to head electronic music studios, computer music studios, and around the United States, to meet me in Den Haag, where the International Computer Music Conference was being held that year in 1986. CDs were, even in 1986, were new. In fact, most composers didn't have a CD player, much less a CD burner. CD burners were just, in fact, not even considered,
I don't think
by that time. It would cost a heck of a lot of money.
Yeah.
You could get one, but it would cost, what, $5,000 to $6,000?
Only in the big production place.
Yes, that's right. That's right. But I had this idea that we could all lock arms and ask our various institutions to put up some money. And cut some CDs, and in fact, a year later we had plans for the first several CDs, and the first release on Centaur Records was in fall 1988. Continued through the years with two or three CDs a year. Coming from those studios, and then with NEA grants and Aaron Copland music recording grants and other kinds of subventions, we managed through the years to now we're at volume 32, just came out. So I've with volume 30, I resigned the position of president of CDCM, which meant I just did all the work. Not all the work, I had colleagues, but and John Nelson at the University of North Texas is now the president, and continuing that, we have a contract with Centaur Records to go through volume 40. I don't know if it will continue through that time, but it has had a lot of circulation, subscribers, and it's a fine repertory of current pieces that involve computers, either computer assisted or computer generated music. The thing I think, looking back, that it characterizes it is that it's the great preponderance. Most of the titles are computer music plus instrumental instruments, or even orchestra, and so forth. with solo CDs thrown in from time to time. So it's different from other series, I think, in that respect. And I guess that ties in with what I said before in terms of my own predilection from the very beginning of my work in electronic music. But it's always, at least at first, was primarily involved with performers and electronic music.
Let's get also back to the sort of difficulty you have. You were at our Otwan Festival in 2001, and one of the presentations was your Williams Remixed.
Yeah.
And it is an 8-channel piece.
Yeah.
How is it possible to maintain a sort of a good spirit as a composer when you are limited to venues where the possibility of 8 channels exists?
Well, it produces a great difficulty, of course. But more and more, specialized venues have multi-channel installations, especially in Europe. It's not as common in the United States. In Canada, of course, multi-channel is almost commonplace, certainly in Montreal, and where the acousmatique school is very strong and has a very highly developed audience and so forth. The same thing goes for Paris, certainly, and now in England over the last 10 years. Multi-channel installations are commonplace. In fact, in just 2 weeks, I'll be going to London, where I'll be giving a presentation of octophonic music at Goldsmiths College. And so when I made myself available to them, I said, do you have an octophonic installation? Yes, they do, and so forth. But it's a good point you make. However, now surround sound is
yes,
almost commonplace, mostly in Dennis. Did you know that's where they sell most of the surround sound installations? Is a dentist, so that the patients can be surrounded by sound and not think about that dental work that they're having done. It's true, or at least it was several years ago. Now there's 8.1, 5.1, and so forth.
So
and with DVD,
these
things are becoming.
Have you reworked some of your own stuff for these encoding systems yet?
I've experimented with it.
Okay.
Yes.
Is it
right now, I have to use ADAS or DA88 tape, in other words, or a computer,
right,
which has that kind of output.
Right. Since we're talking about multiple channels, let's hear some of them. This is the famous Williams Remixed, a composition from 1997 to 2001 based on John Cage's Williams Mix from 1951 to 53. Larry has taken it and done some real marvelous restorations of the theme and then worked it from there. We first heard this in 8 channels at the Otwan Festival of Non-Pop in 2001, and it was very exciting. Here, unfortunately, for you, our listener, it's going to be in stereo. Here we are, all of the sections of Williams Remixed, Larry Austin. Thank you.
Thank you. 1800s.
Thank you.
did.
Earl, what were the circumstances?
Could
I? And we
maybe it didn't. John would come. So he came. You mentioned Luke Welly.
Yeah.
Oh, it came.
What was it like, Earl, to work with John?
Well,
that's all the way here.
Well,
it's incredible how square.
skillful.
And we're, yeah, that's right.
Williams remixed Larry Austin. What is the experience of these many channels of sound? What do they offer that, you know, the stereo or even the sort of encoded surround sound hadn't? What's the difference in the experience? I mean, we have radio listeners who are obviously hearing us only in stereo. So what experience would they, what richness would they gain by hearing this in its actual form?
Well, it becomes more like natural sound. I mean, we're surrounded by sound here in the restaurant. And to recreate that in stereo, you'd say, yeah, that's a recording of a restaurant. But if we were able to, or if we wanted to, recreate that in a performance space, we could more easily and better recreate the environment using multi-channel tapes and speakers and so on. I guess that's the basic difference.
As a composer, though, what creative option is there that makes it possible for you to create in that realm that, that is uniquely different in your communication with your listener?
Movement and coloration. The coloration is clearer. Movement of sound in the space, if you carefully configure the speakers and the space is right And the seating's right, of course. They have to be close to the center, usually. Though with ambisonics, you can sit practically anywhere. That's a multi-channel technique that's been developed, especially in England, where, in fact, you don't have to sit in the center. So what I've found since I got my octophonic gear, especially, and I have a studio with 8.1 speakers and so forth, what I found is that I feel I'm in the middle of the mixer.
Uh-huh.
I feel like I really am very highly sensitized to sound placement. So that you do listen to reflections of sound. Of course, in the concert hall, we'll be hearing
sure.
a piece where that certainly is a crucial issue, and we do hear the sound bouncing, refractions and so
plus
forth.
Plus, you have 50 different sound sources as opposed to two.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I'm still experimenting, actually. It's much more practical just to go with a couple of speakers, certainly. But I hope the listeners, when you play my octophonic CD, Octomix, had some sense of how sound was moving constantly in the stereo field. The standard is stereo, but the coming standard, I think, may approach the surround sound possibilities that I'm working with.
I know you have to go to your pre-concert talk in just a few minutes, so
yeah.
Just another question. If you reflect back over the past half century, what is it like to be a composer now for you? Is this a more rewarding time for you?
It's different. It's not more rewarding. Different. I'm 71 years old now, and so, in fact, there is this reflective nature. I always have... my music's always been about music. I write music about music. It's self-reflexive. And so my latest piece that I'm working on, for Michael Lowenstern, by the way.
Oh, Michael, good. Excellent.
And octophonic. But he said, I must have it in stereo to travel. At any rate, great bass clarinet player. It's called Threnos. And it's another piece where it's a music about music. In this case, it's about Dido and Aeneas of Henry Purcell, which is one of the saddest pieces in all time, a lament. And I couldn't help myself. It was difficult after 9/11 even to get my composing together. I did have a session with Michael in Brooklyn, and had him play some sequences from that piece and Lamentations and the Dies Irae, and now I'm processing them, and they've become a third music, as it were. And I'm really I've had the block pulled away. The difference now for me as a composer, though, is not only reflecting on what you've done, but I care a lot more, I think, about detail now, because I don't have any deadlines I don't have any deadlines, certainly from the university, being retired from the university. And when I accept a commission, I work out the deal so that I have plenty of time to dwell on details, and that's the luxury I'm enjoying now. So I'm probably not as productive as I was that year I described, 1964-65, where I wrote 10 pieces. My God. Or that I described writing this orchestra piece in 3 weeks and scoring it in one.
Right.
I can't imagine doing that today.
Maybe you just need a little extra caffeine in your diet.
Right.
All right, well, we're going to meet you over at the concert.
Okay.
And
it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much for joining us on Calvus and Damien. We hope we'll see you at Zip 3 Non-Pop 2003.
I look forward to it. I'll be there.
Great. Oh, Larry Austin, thanks very much for joining us on the show. We'll wrap up the music of Larry Austin here with one of our favorite topics, lunch.
This is music from a set called Singing the Music of My Own Time, sung with the voice of Thomas Buckner, one of the previous guests on Calvus and Damien a few years ago. Here it is, Larry Austin's Lunch.
And the voice changed things.
Thank you.
Maybe during that period I was in boarding school. Again, the only thing I really liked best was singing. I was singing in the glee club at that school, like starting with freshman year, and I was the only freshman in the glee club. We had almost no social activity, especially here. It kept me as a first tenor because I used to sit up there and I think I had one of the four courses I took. And we had a new choir director for the choir. And he took me aside. He was more of a voice teacher than the other choir director. He was a very good choir director. He was more of an organist. And he discovered that I was pushing my voice up and trying to be a first tenor when actually my voice had really changed and I was American. So that year I started singing on choir. That was really fun. I stayed a first tenor for too long, developed a lot of pitch, and then I kind of got rid of it. That's been a crisis for me throughout my life as a singer. When I think as, you know, people grow up at different rates. I was one of the people who kind of late bloom. I didn't grow my height until my senior year. I was smaller, not the easiest thing in the world. But, and the same thing, hopefully, the darkness, the element, wasn't there for a long, long time. So. Even though my comfortable name is more baritone, you kept saying, well, you might be better because you have a lighter quality. So I would work for it. I was 12 years ago, I left to California to play a group of wild Quebec people. I started right over here. I had to eliminate all the problems. I went back and forth to being a baritone and a tenor and trying to sing higher than that. My first voice lesson was with that. I didn't think I was going to be a pop singer. I still like classical singing best, but I really enjoy doing that. I learned a lot. Since I'd had some army, and there was nobody there who was as interested in music as I was. So I got to be the musician for like the theater company, and I wrote the theater department. And I wrote, sang the lead in all the musicals and wrote music for all the plays. So it was really fun. I had a real active musical life as a singer and fledgling composer. Whereas had I been in a large university musical program, I might have maybe gotten to one project. That was one project. Constantly. I was constantly writing or singing. It was really neat. There I majored in English literature, but as I say, exactly, I was working in theater and writing music. And when I would come back to New York, I studied periodically with a teacher that I found in New York,
Carolina Segrera Holden. She was a good former opera singer, older woman. She helped me a lot. And I had a routine there for the practice, and I always vocalized. But it's nice to work at being self-taught. Maybe mistakes too. There's an attitude towards it, like you're responsible. Singing you rather than just always put something else there. I got a master's in Santa Clara as well. And I went to Stanford to study linguistics. And I was really, I've been very active in Santa Clara. I got a job actually. Summers, music director for Shakespeare and stuff. And I ran a manager. Really, so I got to learn a lot about Elizabethan music. Although I didn't. I actually wrote original musical plays. Some of them were not set in Chicago. I decided to deliver Spanish to the English, the Romantic Spanish and sing it, and teach the other people how to sing it. You know, learning just by doing and having to come up to a certain standard right away. There's no tolerance if you're out there dealing with the public. You know. Being in a larger community of active music writers and performers was very interesting. I learned a lot when I first came out with Hotel Tribune. Can't do that in San Francisco. And so I really enjoyed it. It was partly from the experience of coming to the New Music New York event where I met you in 1979. That made me think, well, geez, that's there.
Those guys are all there. I could be there too. If I hadn't gone to that, I might not have ever gotten the idea.
It's a special event.
So, this was wonderful. Thank you.
Here we are back in
I feel younger having lived through that interview.
Yes,
sort of.
And full because we ate.
Yeah, but somehow the fullness hasn't transmitted itself to, at least to my I'm still hungry.
In your case it would be fulsomeness.
That's it. That's me, fulsomeness.
Yes. Well, next week here on Calvis and Damon. Yes.
You mean this is weekly?
Yes, it is. Actually it's weekly 3 times a month.
That makes more sense.
And,
yes.
And the reason that is because the fourth time a month is Noise Punk and Das Kröner.
If they continue they have been doing.
They have been. And we have a new show posted last week of Noise Punk and Das Kröner. So it proceeds apace two different kinds of approaches to.
And what is a cumulative monetary arrangement that both Kröner and House are realizing? Do you happen to know?
At calvos.org, there's a very lovely button to PayPal, and that remuneration comes from you, our listeners.
Please help.
Yes, please help, because the servers ain't cheap, my friends, and we like to get this stuff out to you. So next week, I was saying.
You were.
Yes, we are again take another time trip. With Rosalie Hirsch to the beautiful...
She's here?
In downtown...
She's here? Rosalie's here?
Rosalie's not here. She's here, but she's not here.
Okay.
And we time travel back to Amsterdam in 2005, where we sat on the Zingel, the canal, and had some
Stolpertorts.
Sort of... We had apple stuff.
Apple torts.
Apple
right.
And coffee, which you clinked a lot, just for effect.
Of course.
Which I've carefully excised. No. Only the loud ones, the ones that caused the meter to go into the red. Anyway, Rosalie Hirsch is here in the house via Amsterdam next week. And then the week after, which will be July 19th, is a Calvos and Damien special live on the air. So July 19th, 2008, in case you're listening later, is the date of an extravaganza with 60 by 60. Rob Voisin and Ann Kamen will be in the studios of WGDR, and you can listen live at WGDR.org and call in your favorite electroacoustic tunes. And we know there's nothing more favorite than electroacoustic tunes.
But, of course, they need to be 60 seconds or less.
Yes, absolutely.
Not any of your John Cage lengthy pieces. Not 3 minutes and 44 seconds. That just won't do. We could play 1 minute of it.
Well, 3 minutes and 44 seconds is
how about 4:33? Yes,
I was going to say, you're short a few minutes of silence.
It's the LTMLDRB kicking in again.
So it was. Okay. All right. So until next week with Rosalie Hearson, 2 weeks from now, July 19th, with Rob Voisey and a live 60 by 60 extravaganza.
We're leaving the house, but we'll leave the light on for you.
Feels bad. It's blind presence. He doesn't see, I guess. I feel him with my hands. Let's see them. My feet see before the touch stirs.
Just the feet
silent touch. Of now I can sleep. Through light, dusk, the day, untrustful night. I read sound into time. Ghost in rhyme to mine, beating my heart in you, my heart in you, beating my heart in you, my heart in you. You.